Welcome to Amplify Your Process Safety, the podcast that provides the experience and expertise you need when it comes to process safety and risk management. Our hands-on approach will give you the insight needed, whether you're new to industry or process safety, in a role where you interact with aspects of process safety, or an experienced process safety professional. Join us in our mission to protect people, the companies they work for, and the communities where they operate by making process safety knowledge available to all.
Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Amplify Your Process Safety podcast. In today's episode, I'm joined by Joe Pastor, and we're going to be talking about another incident investigation report that was issued by the Chemical Safety Board, the CSB, in June 2023. We'll be reviewing an incident that happened at Wacker Polysilicon North America facility in Charleston, Tennessee. The incident occurred on November 13th, 2020. So, Joe, why don't you give us some background on the company and the incident?
Sure. So, some background. Wacker Polysilicon began production at this particular facility in Charleston in 2016, so it was fairly new. They manufacture silicones and hyperpure polycrystalline silicon used in the production of electronics processors and photovoltaics or solar panels. And then in 2019, they also began producing pyrogenic silica, which is used for silicone rubber, paints, coatings, toothpaste, and surprisingly, ketchup. I was kind of surprised to read that in the report. And then they employed approximately 700 people at this facility. So the facility is regulated by PSM and RMP due to the quantity of highly hazardous chemicals because they had hydrogen chloride in excess of 5,000 pounds, which is the threshold quantity. And so when hydrogen chloride is a gas and hydrochloric acid, they are both highly corrosive substances. So the exposure, of course, can cause anything from mild irritation to severe burns. You know, this is very inflammatory to the respiratory tract. You can accumulate liquid in your lungs and unfortunately could lead to death in severe cases. It's also, of course, corrosive not only to our bodies, but to metal alloys that are commonly used in construction. So most of the equipment handling these types of materials have to use special coatings. So in this case, they were using graphite interiors, or I'm not going to attempt this word, polytetrafluoroethylene, PTFE, yep, or Teflon lining. So that is what was used in the vessel that we will talk about in this incident. So What happened on November 13th of 2020, Molly?
Yeah, so just a little bit of background about the PTFE or Teflon lined piping systems. For anybody that's familiar with those, you know that the Teflon has a tendency to flow a little bit, and the piping systems need to be retorqued after they've gone through a thermal cycle because the bolts relax. And if you don't retorque those bolts correctly, you can end up with leaks. So that's a very common issue with Teflon-lined piping systems. So this unit had been down for some maintenance, and they had started back up, and they went through that first thermal cycle, and they had called out some contractors to do the retorquing of the bolts on a heat exchanger that was handling HCl gas. So the contractor was performing that retorquing on a equipment platform that was up on the fifth floor of a structure tower for equipment. It was an operating platform about 70 feet in the air. The platform was equipped with a single staircase for access and egress, so actually relatively generous as some of these platforms go in having an entire staircase to get up and down. Also on that fifth level of the platform, there was another contractor doing some insulation work. is common after a maintenance turnaround. You've got some additional insulation to patch up or repair or install. And so there were two different contract groups of people working up on the fifth floor of this platform. One of them was doing typical insulation work, and the other one was working on the heat exchanger. It was graphite heat exchanger with PTFE piping attached to it, and they were retorquing those flanges. Unfortunately, the workers doing the retorquing tightened those bolts too far. They put too much torque on those bolts, and it caused a leak or crack in the graphite heat exchanger, which then led to a loss of containment of the gaseous HCl. Unfortunately, when that hits the moisture in the air, it formed a dense cloud of acid vapors that really obscured the whole section of platform, and it made it very difficult for the workers to find their way to the stairs to get out of this acidic cloud. Three of the insulators who were not properly attired for exposure to this corrosive vapor essentially panicked in that they couldn't access the stairs and thought that they could instead climb down the exterior of this platform on the piping and so forth to get away from the cloud and get out of harm's way. Unfortunately, that did not work very well, and the three who tried to climb down the outside of the platform fell, resulting in one fatality and two serious injuries. Just from an additional damage standpoint, that loss of containment resulted in some property damage, a little over $200,000 worth of property damage. But in the whole scheme of things, that was the minor piece of the issue. The big issue was the fatality and the two serious injuries.
Right. And one thing I want to point out that you kind of alluded to is that these two different sets of contractors that were up on the platform, one set that was involved with the torquing, they were actually in like chemical suits. They had full respirators on. When they went up there and encountered the other group that was doing the insulation, and that group was only wearing standard PPE, like steel-toed boots, FRCs, safety glasses, that group had asked, oh, we see how you're outfitted. Is yes. it okay for us to be here? Because we're not dressed for exposure. And they were told that it was okay. And so right. they obviously, as you mentioned, were not dressed appropriately for any sort of release. And so I'm sure that that contributed to the panic that happened. And as you said, three of those workers tried to descend, and they did have portable respirators. Mm-hmm. And then a fourth worker had trouble getting hers on and was kind of shielded by a more covered torque contractor. Right. And then, yeah, lots of other issues as well. One of them that was torquing and actually tightening, he mm-hmm. fled when the rupture happened and ripped open right. his suit and started to get chemical burns. So his coworkers put him into the safety shower, which thankfully mm-hmm. was up there. So just, you can imagine just a scrambling that happened because they really did not anticipate that there would be any breach of containment. Right. So they were grossly unprepared, and it was just a really unfortunate situation.
Yeah.
So that kind of leads into one of the safety issues that the CSB identified, and we'll go into all of them. But the biggest one that we think is important to highlight here is simultaneous operations and why they're so problematic. So as we mentioned before, there were two groups of contractors up here. So that's exactly what was going on. So simultaneous operations are when two or more operations are occurring together at the same time and place, and they may interfere with one another. They can increase the risk of either one of the activities, as happened here, or they mm-hmm. can introduce new risks to one or more of the operations.
Right. And that's exactly what happened here. The insulators were doing a very low risk task and dressed for that. Unfortunately, the other contractors that were doing the retorquing elevated the risk to the insulator contractor. This is a new area that the CSB is really highlighting on these simultaneous operations, or sometimes it's referred to as SIMOPS. So when you have multiple groups. It could be contractors, it could be in-house and contractors, it could be just two in-house groups of people, maybe instrument techs and pipe fitters working the same area. But you've got two groups or individuals working together, and it's important when their work is permitted. Generally, everyone in industry that's handling highly hazardous materials has some safe work permit process. And it's important that those permit authorizers understand that there are two groups that need to interact together. You need to understand what each one is doing, what hazards they present, how you might interfere with each other or impact each other. Ensure that you can communicate if something goes wrong that happens with one of the groups. They need to be able to rapidly communicate the situation to the other groups. So the permit authorizers need to understand when there's these simultaneous operations and work together. In this case, unfortunately, when both of these tasks were permitted, the other group didn't happen to be present. So the permit issuers were not really cognizant of the fact that they were working together. The insulation contractor had been authorized for a 3-day job, and they were getting their tools when the permit issuer for the retorquing was there. And when they were going over their job, they didn't see the insulators and vice versa. So that was unfortunate. One other thing that the CSB pointed out with regard to this simultaneous operations that was problematic was this happened in late 2020, which is all of us will never forget. COVID-19 hit that year, and it necessitated a lot of changes to how operations were handled. And in this case, one of the effects was that they limited access into the control room. So in the past, they would have posted all permits in the unit on a board in the control room so the operators could see what was permitted, they understood what was happening. If they had any question, they could look at all those permits and realize, okay, I've got multiple things going on. Because of COVID-19, some of those permits were issued out of a different office, and the permits were just left on a desk there and didn't necessarily make it to the control room. So there was a scattering of where these permits were housed, which made it difficult to understand that they had a simultaneous operation going on.
Exactly. And kind of like you were saying, you know, both groups received permits, but the way that the hazards were reviewed was kind of with tunnel vision and really not in relation to one another. And that's, again, because you said they kind of lacked a formalized process for handling SIMOPS. But that's really important because, of course, in this case, you know, the contractors doing the torquing, they increase the risk to the other contractor. And again, they were only wearing the basic PPE. And like we mentioned before, they even asked at the time, you guys are outfitted differently than us. Do we need to do this? Mm-hmm. And they were told, no, we're not doing any line breaks. You're okay.
Right. Now that question was to the other contractor group.
Right.
It wasn't to their permit issuer or to a member of the Wacker Polysilicon company to confirm, was this okay? And so they were right to ask the question. Perhaps they should have elevated that question and concern. That's one of the hallmarks of a stop work type of thing, is if you have a question about the safety of what you're doing, you need to stop what you're doing and check that out. And so they made an attempt to do that, but they didn't ask somebody knowledgeable enough to clarify. And if they had, probably they would have been told, yeah, you probably shouldn't be working up here in this PPE at this time.
Right. It seemed like it was kind of a little bit too late to be asking at that point, and then they didn't have any follow through. And there actually is a quote in the report from the Wacker permit authorizer. And Penn Gulf is the name of the insulation contractor crew. And Jake Marshall is the contractor crew that was doing the torquing. So he said, well, when I authorized this Penn Gulf permit, the insulation one, none of the Jake Marshall work was going on. When I was out there, none of this was going on. There was nobody else on the structure working when I walked through with Penn Gulf. So again, like you said, it's okay to stop work if conditions change. They were okay to do it when nobody else was on the platform, but that changed. So it was, it would have been okay and fully within their authority to, you know, stop work and reevaluate the hazards.
Right.
And then, as you mentioned, you know, some complications with COVID-19 and how that kind of muddied their processes. But the report also does say, you know, consequently, these Penn Gulf insulation workers lacked awareness of the hazards and were unable to take precautions such as delaying the re-insulation task or donning chemical protective PPE. And as a result, they were unnecessarily exposed to the hazards of the hot torquing task.
So the whole permitting process is the ideal vehicle to scout out and prevent these sorts of problems from cropping up. And unfortunately, Wacker's safe work practice and permit procedure didn't explicitly require consideration of SimOps. And unfortunately, I think that's probably true for many companies. Just the other day, I was talking to a friend who read the same report and got to thinking about her own operation and realized that they didn't consider that in their permits, as far as she was aware, either. And so this is something that a lot of companies really should give some thought to. And unfortunately, there aren't a lot of publicly available and published guidelines or industry standards or even regulations discussing SimOps and how to manage these risks. And so, as we'll get into the recommendations, the CSB had many recommendations focused on these simultaneous operations.
Yeah, and as you said, this is a really big issue, especially in turnaround times when you're trying to accomplish a lot. It's really valuable to have some sort of tool to schedule, you know, contractors to just decrease the risk of these simultaneous operations issues. Right. And that kind of leads us into the next part of the report that we wanted to talk about, which was just that the CSB did highlight other incidents that they have investigated, and it's been at least five others that involve these SimOps. So we'll just kind of go through those really briefly. They are mentioned in a little bit of detail in this report. And then, of course, because they are CSB investigated, they have their own reports as well. So one of those is the Evergreen Packaging Paper Mill. This incident happened in 2020, and there were two fatalities. Also, a second was at CuraRay America. This was an ethylene release and fire in 2018. That one had 23 injuries. And then additionally, there was an Allied Terminals fertilizer tank collapse in 2008 with two injuries. And then Molly, I'll let you kind of walk us through the next two.
Yeah, and then, of course, the BP Texas City incident that I'm sure everybody has heard of before, with 15 fatalities and 180 injuries. And then there was another one, Georgia Pacific predated that back in 2002 with two fatalities and eight injuries. The Evergreen Packaging Paper Mill is one of the first ones that the CSB really highlighted these SimOps. And that one was very similar to this particular incident in that there were two contract companies. At that point, I think they were working in a confined space, but one of them started a fire and didn't have good means to communicate with the other contract crew because they were a different company. And that led to the fatalities. The other ones are focused on non-standard operations and startups and things like that, where there are personnel that are maybe not essential for that activity and lack of communication on what's going on and what the risks are and coordinating those. So this is something that's getting more attention with these two recent incidents from 2020 through the CSB. And it's something that companies should really give some thought to on better coordinating and handling those.
Definitely. And although they didn't consider the simultaneous operations issues that this ended up resulting in, they did consider in their PHA a release here. So can you talk a little bit to us about that, Molly?
Yeah, so their PHA, interestingly enough, had a what-if scenario that was essentially the same as what actually happened. What if there is a release while people are working up on this platform and the release blocks access to the staircase that is used to egress from that platform? This PHA was conducted just 3 months prior to the incident, and the PHA team had recommended that they add an additional means of egress, maybe a closed ladder with a cage to get down on the opposite side of the platform from the staircase, so that there would be an alternate means of egress. Unfortunately, that PHA recommendation was assigned to a manager of the process and facilities engineering, but it didn't include a timeline or any due date for implementation. Now, I realize that adding a ladder cage for a platform is not something that is easy to do, you know, in a matter of days or weeks. For PHA recommendations, if it's like a procedure update, then those really should be done very, very quickly. When you're talking about asset changes and things of that sort, I realize that there's often financial approvals that have to get done. You got to do some design work and all of that sort of stuff. But what companies need to keep in mind is that when you have a PHA recommendation such as this, it needs to get assigned with a due date and perhaps some interim target dates of, okay, we need to do an engineering design and feasibility by such and such a date. We want to target getting our capital approved by this date. Then we'll implement it by a later date. So in this case, the PHA recommendation was out there identical to the incident that happened. It highlighted the risk. It highlighted the concern and a recommendation. And unfortunately, it appears that it fell off the table on terms of implementation, which was very unfortunate.
Right. And we recognize that 3 months is a relatively short period of time to, you know, have addressed all of the action items from your PHA. But in this case, you know, they had the hindsight to consider this scenario. And, you know, we don't have access to their PHA, but I assume that the severity of the consequence was quite high in this case due to the nature of the materials that they were handling. And so, you know, as you mentioned, they really needed to set a due date, but they also could have, you know, done something in the interim, like, okay, so then because we don't have this fully resolved yet, you know, let's not have anybody on that platform unless they're fully donned in chemical suits and respirators. So there were some things that they could have done. So really important to, you know, when you get the results of your PHA, look and see what recommendations you have. And of course, assign priority and due dates and and people who are responsible. But also look at your more high risk scenarios and see, do you need to put in a temporary MOC? Do you need to have a temporary policy in place so that you can mitigate the risk in the meantime? Because, yeah, it was great that they thought of this and addressed in their PHA, but, you know, not really great because they didn't end up being able to do anything about it before this occurred. Exactly. So just important to keep in mind.
Right. Yeah. So what were some of the other findings or contributing factors that the CSB pointed out?
Yeah. So one of the contributing factors that the CSB pointed to was written procedures, or I guess in this case, lack thereof. So the TORC contractors, they weren't provided with written procedures for their task. And as we all know, there's so much paperwork involved in any of these processes. And so what ended up happening is that there was a vendor drawing that called out a torque requirement of 15 pounds. And then there was other documentation that said 40, and they misunderstood which particular flanges needed which amount of torquing. Right. So they ended up torquing everything to 40, which is why you can understand the one where the max was 15 is ultimately what led to the rupture. So they just really didn't have not only did they not have a written procedure, they didn't have all the documentation available at the same time and place. And so the procedure could have prevented this accident because it, you know, when you write the procedure, you reference all of this material and you put it into, you know, a little bit more of a bite-sized fit for purpose document. And so while they did have all the information available, like we said, in documentation somewhere, it wasn't really easily available and easily digestible at the time.
Right. And the other thing is that the contractors that were doing the torquing had readily available this OEM manual for the Teflon line piping, which is most of what they were working with. And that's probably what those pipe fitters are familiar with. That's a very common. But the joint between the graphite exchanger and the Teflon line piping is where they needed a lower torque setting because of the graphite. And that's what got missed. They thought that they were torquing them all the same. And if somebody had taken the time to write up the procedure, they probably would have realized as they were going through that, that, oh, I've got one joint that's graphite to Teflon, and then the rest that are all Teflon to Teflon.
Exactly. It kind of reminds me of the last incident that you and I covered where they removed too much of
the plug valve.
Actuator. The plug valve. Yeah. And the cover. And it's like, it's almost the same case because it's just so easy for there to be a misunderstanding about what to remove or how much to torque something when things aren't either labeled explicitly or you don't have like step-by-step instructions. It's just so easy to make a mistake. So
it kind of reminds me. In this case, it was a fatal mistake.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And then the next contributing factor that the CSB identified had to do with control of hazardous energy. So can you talk us through that one a little bit, Molly?
Yeah. So again, just like that last incident that you and I reported on, where they were trying to take off a valve actuator and they weren't intending to do any line break. They weren't intending to open up the piping to hazardous material. With this retorquing activity, again, they're just tightening the bolts on the exterior of the piping system. They're not intending to break that pressure envelope. They're not looking to cause any sort of loss in containment. But whenever you're working on that piping system and it does contain hazardous chemicals, there's always a risk of a loss of containment, as happened here. It appears that the permit didn't take into account that potential, or at least not enough caution was taken. There were some things that they could have done, such as depressurizing the system, perhaps purging it, or at least getting it to a more neutral state. So if there was a leak, it didn't have pressurized hot HCl gas coming out of that crack. So that was something that should have been considered when they were issuing the permit. The permit had places to mark whether they needed to follow provisions for control of hazardous energy, and those were all marked as not applicable because they weren't intending to do a line break. But you should still consider that possibility.
Right. Like you said, just because it's not applicable doesn't mean that it won't happen unintentionally.
Right. Exactly.
So it's good to consider, you know, worst case scenario. Another contributing factor was the limited means of egress, of course. And so there was that single set of stairs. It did meet the code requirements for the platform because the platform was technically considered an unoccupied elevated platform used exclusively for mechanical systems or industrial process equipment, which, as you've mentioned, is really common. So they technically were up to code under that requirement and that definition of what the platform was used for. Although, of course, as we saw here, these maintenance activities could happen all the time. And so you would have cases where it is not normally unoccupied anymore. So there could be multiple people up there for extended periods of time, as in this case. And then, you know, as we mentioned before, one of these contractors was going to be there for multiple days. So not really unoccupied in that case.
Yeah. And so CSB pointed out that the building codes don't really consider this type of use. Granted, these platforms are very common and they are normally unoccupied, but during maintenance turnarounds or construction, although under construction, there may not be materials there unless you're doing like an addition. In that case, there may be construction going on while there is also hazardous material in the equipment elsewhere on the platform. But maintenance turnarounds or startups are a key time when there may be multiple people working on a platform for entire shifts or days or weeks on end. So they're no longer unoccupied. And often they're equipped with a single means of egress. As I mentioned earlier, this one had a staircase, which compared to a lot of platforms I've seen is actually on the generous side. A lot of times there may be just a ladder going down one side. When you have lots of contractors working in an area like this one, there were seven people up on the platform at the time that were intended to be up there for hours on end. The CSB pointed out that a lot of code-making bodies, regulatory bodies, should probably reconsider the requirements for this type of platform with the understanding that there are times when they are heavily occupied and make provisions and requirements for dealing with that. I don't know where they'll go with those recommendations, but I think it is a valid point that the CSB is bringing up that these platforms at certain points in time are heavily occupied. And as you mentioned earlier in the PHA, the team had pointed out that this was a risk. The CSB also mentioned that in conversations with a lot of employees, there were multiple people who had suggested recommendations that there needed to be another means of egress from that platform because they knew people worked up there at various times and they handled hazardous material, which had the potential, as in this incident, to block access to those stairs. So that's something that really should be taken into consideration. Just because you meet code doesn't mean that you've adequately addressed the risks that you have. Codes are very general. They set out a minimum accepted threshold. But if your situation is such that you need extra means of egress, you should look into those.
Right, especially when it's being brought up by employees. I mean, it's good to identify it in your PHA, of course, as well, but It's, you know, it means something also when your employees are bringing it up, the employees who, you know, are familiar with the process and working in it every day. The report says WACKER maintained an online safety suggestion system In which employees could submit this kind of safety related feedback. And so the CSB said multiple employees mentioned either talking with management or submitting through this Online feedback portal about a need for a secondary means of egress. And the report said, however, interviews with WACKER employees indicated a perception among the workers that management deferred employee concerns regarding secondary egress because of management's understanding that the building was designed per code. So Whether or not they felt that way, that was the workers' perception. But it just kind of goes back to what you said about, you know, the code is the minimum requirements. It doesn't mean that you can't do more. And certainly, you know, in this case, it warranted the consideration for adding another means of egress. And It could have been very helpful in this situation.
Right. Okay. So the CSB had several recommendations, kind of touched on some of those, but we'll run through them briefly here. So what was their updated recommendation, Joe?
Yes. So that was to require owner operators to ensure the proper coordination of simultaneous operations involving multiple work groups, including contractors. And then they had two recommendations to OSHA.
Similar to that about the updated recommendation, this is for OSHA to promulgate or modify existing standards to require employers to coordinate these simultaneous operations involving multiple work groups, including contractors. They also want to make sure that the requirements apply to both general industry and construction activities, and that they're not limited to just confined space. There is some recommendations for confined space coordination, but they want a standard that is much broader based that would catch situations such as this one. There was a similar recommendation directed specific to the Tennessee OSHA, since they have their own state body. And then secondarily, they wanted to have them develop a safety product providing some guidance on the coordination of these simultaneous operations that could be a reference in addition to a standard. Hopefully they could provide that guidance in a faster time frame than modifying or promulgating a new standard.
Right.
So that was for the regulatory side. What did they have for WACKR?
Yes. So for WACKR, they had 4 recommendations. First, develop detailed maintenance procedures for torquing activities, because those didn't exist. Second, develop policy requirements to ensure that torquing activities performed on equipment that contains hazardous energy are safely performed, such as de-inventorying or restriction of non-essential personnel, and ensure that essential workers wear proper PPE. So pretty specific to what happened in this situation. Third was to develop and implement a formalized SimOps program addressing planned and or permitted co-located work tasks. So obviously that would have been very beneficial in this situation. And then fourth was to install additional means of egress for this tower platform and other multi-floor equipment structures on site. So all pretty, I would say, fit for purpose for this situation. Okay. And then the CSB did make a recommendation to CCPS.
Right. So the Center for Chemical Process Safety is a branch of AICHE that publishes a lot of great reference materials, guideline books, and so forth. And the CSB asked them to develop and publish a safety product. Might be a guidelines book, might be a white paper or something of that sort on safe work practices, including detailed and practical guidelines for evaluating these simultaneous operations. The CCPS is a, like the CSB, is a valuable resource for handling highly hazardous materials. And so they asked that they step into this breach and help fill that gap. Also for the International Code Council for Building Codes, what did they say there?
Yes. So the CSB asked that they amend the International Building Code to address conditions that may require multiple means of egress from elevated equipment platforms used for accessing equipment that contain materials that pose physical and health hazards, such as this one. And they said that they really should specify the number of egress points to increase the likelihood of worker escape in the event of a release. So essentially that, you know, one egress point is not necessarily adequate. Right. And then finally, the CSB made one recommendation to the NFPA.
Right. So the NFPA has a code 101 for life safety code. They've also got some other related codes that they thought might be suitable for upgrading, such as NFPA 55 for compressed gases and cryogenic fluids code, or NFPA 400, the hazardous materials code, that could address conditions that may require multiple means of egress from elevated structures. The NFPA has some guidance for that, but it's focused on flammability. And they ask that they look at updating those standards for addressing structures containing hazardous materials that pose physical or health hazards, regardless of the combustibility. As in this case, it was a corrosive nature, not necessarily flammability, that caused the problem. So they asked that they, like the International Code Council, look to upgrading some of those code standards so that companies have some further guidance on when they might need more than one means of egress.
Right. And then finally, you know, we always like to kind of zoom out from the incident when we cover these final reports from the CSB and kind of talk about what any company can learn from this accident. So perhaps you don't have, you know, a 70-foot platform at your facility. Perhaps you don't have hydrogen chloride at all. You know, there are many differences between your facility and the one that experienced this incident. but we think there are just key learnings that anybody in industry could keep in mind. And, you know, that's something that is valuable that comes mm-hmm. out of something so unfortunate. So we do want to make sure to highlight those. There are key lessons for the industry that are pointed out on page 55 of the CSB report, and we'll link to it, of course, but we just want to cover those briefly. So first, of course, has to do with SimOps. So ensure additional coordination and review for any simultaneous operations that you have at your facility, whether they are external contractors or internal workers or any combination of the two. And second, you know, make sure you do risk assessments for maintenance work that could result in a loss of containment, even if that's not what your intended operation is. Like we mentioned before, just because you don't think it's going to involve a line break doesn't mean that you shouldn't assess the risk if that does end up happening.
Right.
And then what else, Molly, what else can companies learn?
Yeah, so as we talked about before with written instructions, make sure that you've got written instructions for maintenance work. We know that the PSM standard has very clear requirements for procedures. Maintenance is often lacking in that regard. So make sure that you have those available. Don't rely on just the generic original equipment manufacturer OEM manuals that are written in a very generic text. You can use those as a starting point, but make your maintenance procedures very specific. Use written procedures, not just relying on verbal past descriptions passed along from one person to the next. Have it written down for reference. And also make use of photos where appropriate. In this case, a photo would have been hugely helpful in pointing out that, okay, these bolts need 15 foot-pounds and all the rest of these need 40 foot-pounds of torque. So that would have been helpful. Also, watch out when you use kind of jargon or vernacular. In this case, Wacker had a description of hot torquing, and what that actually meant was different depending on who was using it or what context they had. In some cases, it was intended as you go through a thermal cycle on this PTFE piping and you take it up to temperature and then bring it back down and retorque. Other cases, they use that to mean you had it up at operating temperature and you were torquing it at that temperature. So that led to some confusion. So watch out for any sort of jargon and things like that to make sure that that's clearly understood. And then finally, if you've got PHA recommendations, make sure that those are addressed in a timely manner. If it's going to take a while to implement your solution, have a plan, document what you're intending to do, and lay out some due dates, including interim due dates if necessary. Unlike some of the CSB reports where a lot of these learnings are tailored to the very specific incident, I think pretty much all of these learnings from this incident investigation are broadly applicable to many, many industries, and I think everyone can learn a lot from this one.
Agreed. So if you have a comment about our episode this week, or you have an idea for a future episode or a question about anything process safety related, we'd love to hear from you. You can send a voice message using the link in our episode description, or just shoot us an email at podcast@amplifyconsultants.com.
Yes, and we would like to thank the CSB again for their important work in conducting these incident investigations. They provide industry guidance so that hopefully no one else has to suffer similar adverse consequences and that they can learn from others' mistakes. This podcast is our way of trying to help get the word out about these incident investigations. And if you want to see some of our reviews of other ones, you can search our podcast for Incident Breakdown in the podcast library to find out others. And as we mentioned, for further details, please go ahead and visit the CSB website and read their full incident report. You can find that at csb.gov.
And finally, our goal at Amplify Process Safety is to save lives by partnering with companies that handle highly hazardous chemicals to create world-class process safety systems, as it is our firm belief that these systems will help to prevent catastrophic incidents like fires, explosions, and toxic releases. So please don't hesitate to reach out to us if we can help guide you on your process safety journey. Thank you for listening, and until next time, be safe out there.
We appreciate you joining us for this episode of Amplify Your Process Safety. Head to our website, amplifyconsultants.com, to find our show notes and other resources. Thank you for joining us in our mission to ultimately save lives by advancing process safety right here on Amplify Your Process Safety. Until next time.